We're delighted to have Zadie Smith with us tonight. We'll hear her read, and then she'll be joined for a conversation with Professor Karen Zumkog in the Ethics Play. And then Zadie will sign books at the back of the room after the reading. And now I'd like to welcome Senior Anna Curry, who will introduce Zadie to us.
Hi, thank you all for coming. We are so excited and honored to have Zadie Smith here as part of Tulane's Zale Kimmerling Writer in Residence Program. As many of you know, she is an author of 6 critically acclaimed books and is currently working on her highly anticipated novel, Swing Time. Her sharply observed fiction frequently grapples with the complexities of race and class in her native London and elsewhere. Her work has won the Orange Prize for Fiction, the Whitbread First Novel Award, and the Commonwealth Writers Prize, among others. She is now a professor of creative writing at New York University. Please join me in welcoming Zadie Smith.
Hi, it's lovely to be here. So usually when I read, I guess I'm reading something funny. But today I'm not going to read something funny, so I just want you to prepare for the fact that I'm not going to be funny for about 12 minutes. This is a short story I wrote recently. It hasn't been published yet. And I guess I was thinking about suffering and pain, excuse me. And I was trying to think, I wanted to write a story about those things, but I always write from a very local perspective, I guess, intensely local one way or another. And I thought, is there a way to write a story not just about one person's pain in one particular place, but about pain in general, in all places, at all times, amongst all people. So that was the idea. And here we go. It's called Two Men Arrive in a Village. Two men arrive in a village. Sometimes on horseback, sometimes by foot, in a car or astride motorbikes, occasionally in a tank, having strayed far from the main phalanx, and every now and then from above, in helicopters. But if we look at the largest possible picture, the longest view, we must admit that it is by foot that they have mostly come. And so in this sense, at least, our example is representative. In fact, it has the perfection of parable. Two men arrive in a village by foot, and always a village, never a town. If two men arrive in a town, they will obviously arrive with more men, and far more in the way of supplies. That's simple common sense. But when two men arrive in a village, their only tools may be their own dark or light hands, depending. Though most often they will have in these hands a blade of some kind, a spear, a longsword, a dagger, a flick knife, a machete, or just a couple of old razors. Sometimes a gun. It has depended and continues to depend. But what we can say with surety is that when these two men arrived in the village, we spotted them at once, at the horizon point where the long road that leads to the next village meets the setting sun. And we understood what they meant by coming at this time. Sunset has historically been a good time for the two men, wherever they have arrived. For at sunset, we are all still together. The women are only just back from the desert, or the farm, or the city offices, or the icy mountains. The children are playing in dust near the chickens, or in the communal garden outside the modernist apartment block. The boys are lying in the shade of cashew trees, seeking relief from the terrible heat, if they are not in a far colder country, tagging the underside of a railway bridge. And most importantly, perhaps, the teenage girls are out in front of their huts or houses or tents or apartments, wearing their jeans or their saris or their veils or their lycra miniskirts, cleaning or preparing food or grinding meat or texting on their phones, depending. And of course, the able-bodied men are not back yet from wherever they have been. Night, too, has its advantages, and no one can deny that the two men have often arrived on horseback, or barefoot, or by canoe, or clinging to each other on a Suzuki scooter, or riding atop a commandeered government jeep, in the middle of the night, therefore taking advantage of the element of surprise. But absolute darkness has also its disadvantages. And because the two men always arrive in villages and never in towns, they are almost always met, if they come at night, with absolute darkness, no matter where in the world or their long history you may come across them. Most villages are still absolutely dark at night. And in such darkness, you cannot be exactly sure whose ankle it is you have a hold of, a crone, a wife, or a girl in the first flush of youth. But it goes without saying that one of the men is almost always tall, rather handsome, in a vulgar way, a little dim and vicious, while the other man is shorter, weasel-faced, and sly. This short, sly man leaned on the Coca-Cola hoarding that marked the entrance to the village and raised a hand in friendly greeting, while his friend took the small stick that he had up to that point been chewing, threw it on the ground, and smiled. They could just as well have been leaning on a lamppost and chewing gum, and the smell of borscht could have been in the air, but in our village we do not make borscht. We eat couscous and tilefish, and this was the smell in the air, tilefish, which even to this day we can hardly bear to smell because of the manner in which it reminds us of the day two men arrived in the village. The tall one raised his hand in friendly greeting. At which moment the cousin of the wife of the chief, who happened to be walking across the road that leads to the next village, felt she had no choice but to stop opposite the tall man, his machete glorious in the sun, and raise her hand, though her whole arm shook as she did so. The two men liked to arrive in this manner, with a more or less friendly greeting. And this might remind us of the obvious fact that all humans, no matter what they do, like very much to be liked, even if it's only for an hour or so before they're feared or hated. Or maybe it would be better to say that they like the fear which they create to be leavened with other things, like desire or curiosity, even if, in the final analysis, fear is always the greater part of what they want. Food is cooked for them. We offer to make them food, or else they demand it, depending. At other times, on the 14th floor of a derelict apartment building covered in snow, in which a village lives vertically, the two men will squeeze onto a family sofa in front of their television and watch the new government's broadcast, the new government they have just established by coup. And the two men watching this, and despite the fact that they are supposedly representatives of this very government, will laugh at their new leader marching up and down the parade ground in that stupid hat. And as they laugh, they will hold the oldest girl watching television by her shoulder in a supposedly friendly manner, but a little too tightly, while she weeps. "Aren't we friends?" the tall, dim man asked her. "Aren't we all friends here?" And this is one way they arrived, though they did not arrive that way here. We have no televisions here and no snow and have never lived above the level of the ground. And yet the effect is the same, the dread stillness and the anticipation. Another girl, younger, brought the plates of food for the two men, or in our village, a single bowl. "This is good shit," said the tall, handsome, stupid one, scooping up tilefish with his dirty fingers. And the little sly one, with the face of a rat, said, "Ah, my mother used to make it like this. God rest her shitty old soul." And as they ate, they bounced a girl each on their laps, while the older women pressed themselves against the compound walls and wept. Well, after eating and drinking, if it is a village in which alcohol is permitted, the two men will take a walk around to see what is to be seen. This is the time of stealing. The two men will always steal things, though for some reason they do not like to use this word, and as they reach out for your watch or cigarettes or wallet or phone or daughter, the short one in particular will say solemn things like, "Thank you for your gift," or "We appreciate the sacrifice you're making for the cause." Though this will set the tall one laughing and thus ruin whatever dignified effect the short one was trying to achieve. At some point, as they move from home to home, taking whatever they please, a brave boy, not long into his maturity, will leap out from behind his mother's skirts and try to overpower the short, sly man. In our village, this boy was a 14-year-old. We all used to call King Frog, due to the fact that once, when he was about 4 or 5 years old, somebody asked him who had the most power in our village, and he pointed to a big ugly toad in the yard and said, "Him, King Frog." And when asked why, explained, "Because even my father is afraid of him." At 14, he was brave, but reckless, which was why his white-hipped mother had thought to tuck him behind her skirts as if he were a baby. But there is such a thing as physical courage, real, persistent, very hard to explain, existing in tiny pockets here, there, and everywhere. And though almost always useless, it is still something you don't easily forget once you've seen it, like a very beautiful face or a great mountain range. It sets a limit somehow on your own hopes for yourself. And sensing this, maybe, the tall, dim one raised his gleaming machete and with the same fluid yet effortless gesture with which you might take the head off a flower, separated the boy from his life. Once blood has been shed, especially such a quantity of blood, a kind of wildness descends, a bloody chaos, into which all the formal gestures of welcome and food and threat seem instantly to dissolve. More drink is generally taken at this point, and what is strange is that the old men in the village, who, though men, have no defence, will often now grab at the bottles themselves, drinking deeply and weeping. For you need courage, not only to commit bloody chaos, but also to sit by and watch it happen. But the women. How proud we were, in retrospect, of our women, who stood in formation, arms linked the one to the next, in a ring around our girls, as the tall, dim man became agitated and spat on the floor. What's wrong with these bitches? Waiting is over any longer and I'll be too drunk. And the short, sly one stroked the face of the chief's wife's cousin. The chief's wife was in the next village, visiting family. And spoke in sly, low tones of the coming babies of the revolution. We understand that women stood so in ancient times, besides white stone and blue seas, and more recently in villages of the elephant god, and in many other places, old and new. Still, there was something especially moving about the pointless courage of our women at that moment, though of course it could not stop two men arriving in the village and doing their worst. It never has, and never will. And yet there came that brief moment when the tall, dim one seemed cowed and unsure, as if it were his own mother now spitting at him, which passed soon enough when the short, sly one kicked the spitting woman in her groin, and the formation broke, and bloody chaos found no more obstruction to its usual plans. The next day, the story of what happened is retold in partial, broken versions, depending very much on who is asking. A soldier, a husband, a woman with a clipboard, a morbidly curious visitor from the next village, or the chief's wife, returned from her sister-in-law's compound. Most will put a great emphasis on certain questions. Who were they? Who were these men? What were their names? What language did they speak? What marks were on their hands and faces? But in our village, we are very fortunate to have no rigid bureaucrats, but instead the chief's wife, who is, when all is said and done, more of a chief to us than the chief has ever been. She is tall and handsome and sly and courageous. She believes in the Ga Haramata, that wind which blows here hot, here cold, depending, and which everybody breathes in. You cannot help but breathe it in, though only some will breathe out in bloody chaos. For her, such people become nothing more than Ga Haramata. They lose themselves, their names, and faces, and can no longer claim merely to bring the whirlwind. They are that wind. This is, of course, a metaphor. But she lives by it. She went straight to the girls and asked for their account, and found one who, encouraged by the sympathetic manner of the chief's wife, told her story in full, the end of which was the most strange. For the short, sly one had thought himself in love, and afterward laying his sweaty head on this girl's bare chest, had told her that he, too, was an orphan. Though it was harder for him, for he had been an orphan for many years, rather than mere hours. And that he had a name and a life, and was not just a monster, but a boy who had suffered as all men suffer, and had seen horror, and wanted now only to have babies with this girl from our village. Many boy babies, strong and beautiful, and girls too. Yes, why not girls? And live far from all villages and towns, with this army of children encircling them and protecting the couple all their days. He wanted me to know his name, exclaimed the girl, still stunned by the idea. He had no shame. He said he did not want to think that he had passed through my village or my body without anybody caring what he was called. It is probably not his real name, but he said his name was... But our chief's wife stood up suddenly, left the room, and walked out into the yard. Thank you.